accession number 23787, reel 4.
Major Dillon, reel 4. We were talking about your time with L Detachment, later to be the SAS, but and we're talking in particular on the Benghazi raid,
yep.
The ill-fated Benghazi raid. You've described the Jeep. What were you told you were going to do with these 40 Jeeps? I mean, what were you told about the plan?
The plan was to raid Benghazi, to sink whatever ships were alongside, with the exception of one, which the harbour master was responsible for moving with an Arab tugboat or something, to sink in the harbour mouth as a block ship. And one other ship to be got out in order to, if we couldn't get out by road, we'd have a vessel to evacuate down the coast in. That was the broad plan, was to sink any shipping in the harbour, block the harbour, and also escape from the harbour. The same night, by the way, the raid on Tobruk went on, which was led by the LRDG. Same night, David Lloyd Owen, which also ended disaster.
Now, were there any details about how you get there?
Yes.
What do you remember of that?
Well, I can remember my own orders were fairly explicit, because David Sterling had done a recce disguised as an Italian officer. He'd driven all around Benghazi. And anyway, we knew Benghazi from the time we'd been there. We knew our way about. My particular thing was to go drive down into the docks and capture a ship, one ship, whatever it was, my ship, and sink it alongside, put some mines. Quite straightforward.
And other
similar. And the paymaster to find the bank and open the safe.
Now, I should know, but I've forgotten. What was the date of the Benghazi raid?
Well, God.
You've forgotten as well.
I've forgotten. It's recorded. That
must
be.
Yeah, we can find that out easily. Now, what do you remember of the raid? Right from... Any preparations before you set off?
Other than the briefing, most of us... Well, Geoffrey and I were desert trained, although one looked at some of the people involved and realised it was a naval party, obviously not desert trained, with the very white knees, one or two. But by and large, they were fairly competent. The difference between desert worthy and not was very apparent as soon as you set out. You had to know how to drive in the desert and all that sort of thing. The move up to Benghazi was tiring but totally uneventful.
What was it like driving through the desert on that? It'd be done at night, would it?
No, we drove night and day.
How long did it take?
It's 800 miles. 3 or 4 days, I suppose. I honestly can't remember. We were not interfered with at all, which was, in retrospect, rather surprising. No reconnaissance, nothing.
Did you go well out into the desert, or just
what we had to avoid was the sand sea. Again, this business of going maps. The sand sea impinged across. We went around it a bit. So it was basically hard desert. Quite good going, mostly. Quite good going. And then rocky towards the end. And the timings and everything had been arranged. We were to meet outside Benghazi at a rendezvous. The SOE man, whose name, Hazelden, was an SOE man in Benghazi, was due to meet us as our local guide. He came out in high dudgeon, said, "David, it's off. You better get on to Cairo. You're expected." The Italians have withdrawn a division and the Germans a regiment. Garrison has been heavily reinforced. You are expected. We'd all been issued with Benzedrine in that state because we were tired. You know, Benzedrine is to keep you going. So we were then told to get our heads down and go to sleep. You can't if you've taken Benzedrine. Whilst David got on, had to encode a message back to Cairo, and it took until tomorrow morning to get an answer. And the answer came back, disregard bizarre gossip and proceed with raid as instructed. That was exact wording of the signal. So David said, well, here we go. And I have a vivid memory of what happened.
If you tell us as much detail as you can, what happened?
In Leatherhead, we went down this defile, which David had wrecked, with Fitzroy MacLean, who spoke Italian, was IO at the time. And we down this defile, which was a sort of back road into Benghazi, and halfway down was a what you call it, barrier, you know, these drop barriers. And Bill Cumper was a sapper officer. He said, Bill, open that barricade. Very good, sir. And we were also, it was dead silence, nothing, couldn't hear anything. We thought we could hear sort of rustling in the bushes each side. It was pitched up. We all had our headlights on. So Bill went forward, pulled the pin out of the thing and threw it up and shouted, I remember to this day, it's in the SS history, gentlemen, let battle commence. And the first three jeeps went forward, went straight up on mines, which had been laid. And then all hell was let loose at about 50 yards range. It seemed to go on forever.
So you'd been ambushed?
Ambushed. Expected and ambushed. And David was standing quite near our jeep, and I remember he was quite calm. He said, I think we best get out of here. I remember, so we did. We eventually got out, and then...
Did you have any casualties?
Yes, about 25. I had several on my jeep, nobody was hit on my jeep, but I had took some wounded on it. We got out.
How did you get the wounded on there? Who picked them up and put them on your jeep?
I forget. Anyway, some could walk, some we got out.
What sort of fire was it? Was it
light automatic, small arms. We had an RV, which is where Hazel had met. It was about 25 miles outside Benghazi, and the order was to go back to the RV. And I'm not a very brave chap. I thought, well, we're in Stuck now. We really are in shit. We're 800 miles from home. The great thing is, let's get away from people. Don't get amongst a crowd. Jeff agreed, and we were both fairly competent in our own ability. We separated, we got out of this defile, back onto the desert. It was still dark, and I said, what we've got to do is find somewhere to hide, because we'll never get back to the RV before daylight, and there'll all be all hell let loose soon as daylight. We managed to hide the jeep in some scrub, and we hid ourselves. The driver, and there was a wounded man. Well, and somebody, and another jeep, there were two, yes, another jeep. And then it got light, and we camouflaged, we hid everything, and I said to everybody, under no circumstances shall I tell, does anybody move or do anything? I said, we want to have a PUP where you're sitting. No movement. And then we saw SAS jeeps all over the place and airplanes, one after, zunk, zunk, zunk. I said, now then, do not move. Nobody move. We lay there all day, and this strafing went on. And at night we got back to the RV, and the remnants had foregathered at this RV, and we thought, well, here we are. The next morning, we were getting ready to move, and we were attacked. They'd spotted it, and we were given away. There was a Free French element with us. The order, David said, quite right, under no circumstances, because we've well camouflaged, does anybody shoot? The Free French, of course, opened fire on this reconnaissance plane. Then, that was about 1 o'clock, lunchtime. Then they started to come. And they went on to the last light, one after the other.
These Stukas, or...?
They were mostly Italian Mackie fighters. And it went on and on and on.
What
and
was
I was shit scared. I really was shit scared.
What were the attacks like? I mean, can you give us an idea of what it was like to be in that situation?
Very frightening. I didn't realise that we were in this wadi, that I'd lain down. I know I could be seen. I was with my head under a bush. I got white corduroy trousers on, very pale. I knew the pilot could see me. I could see him over my shoulder. But I was just happened to be at the right height. If he lured himself sufficiently to hit me, he'd have flown the cliff. He came in about three times and he kept firing at the top of my head like about that high. So, that was, I think, the worst experience. If I'd been further up or further down, he'd have got me. But I just happened to lie there. And Jeff was a bit further up, and laughing his head off. I said, well, you bloody well laughed, Jeff. And with us was amongst others, was an RAF officer who was brought along in case we needed our help on the way back. He was a fighter pilot, and I remember talking to him in Cairo afterwards over a drink. He said, I've often strafed people on the ground. I honestly promise you I'll never do it again. I've never been so shit scared in my life, he said. I said, neither have I. So then...
Was your vehicle damaged?
No, it so happened. It was in a crack and it survived. And then David asked Jeffrey and I if we'd stay behind. And I said to Jeff, yes, volunteer. I instinctively wanted to get away from the herd. We were very confident in our own ability as being desert worthy. We had a good vehicle. We had enough fuel. I knew how to navigate. So we volunteered to stay behind.
Now, why were you staying behind? What was the point of that?
Any further stragglers. David said the time has come to move, but there may be other stragglers who've lain up somewhere. I would like somebody to volunteer to stay behind. So I said, yes, I would. Selfishly, honestly, if the truth be known. And we found, there we were, we moved away a bit from the actual wadi where we'd been, found another place nearby from where we could observe and hid up, and they all rumbled away. And he said, thank God for that, they've gone. And then about 2 o'clock in the morning we heard vehicles. Christ, the Germans can't have found us. They'd come back because they realized that they had got, whoever it was navigated, realized that they'd started too late to get out of fighter range before first light tomorrow, so they'd come back. But anyway, they went the next night. We then had to go, we stayed, and then we went back with the main party eventually to Kufra. And we got to Jalo, first of all, which was halfway, I don't know if you know Jalo, oasis of which the Sudan Defense Force was supposed to have captured for us to withdraw to. They had failed. So, Dustin, whereas we were, we joined in and managed to recapture half the oasis, refilled with water. And there the Germans found us again, and more of this horrendous air attack business. With the Sudan, I remember with the Sudan Defense Force officer in a 1,500-weight truck, he said, I've got a theory, oh boy, we were in the open, being dive-bombed by this JU-52, twin-engine thing. He said, I've got a theory, oh boy. If you drive straight at these buggers when they dive, they can't hit you. We were miles in the open, like a polo field. I said, I don't you think it would be better if we just bail out and hope for the best? No, no, he said, trust me, oh boy. And this happened 3 times. This fella came at us, and he said, you tell me, oh boy, as soon as he's committed to his dive. I can even straight for him like that with his toe down. Zoom, over the top. Told you. Did you see that he ran out of ammunition and flew off? It worked. He said, a sailor told me, that's what they do in a ship. They drive straight at the thing as soon as it's committed to the dive. So that was Jalo. And we got back to Kufra. We thought, well, we're all right here at Kufra. We were out of range, 800 miles. But they had a long-range ME-110. They did raid us. And I was in her... And David Lloyd Owen, the NRDD chap, who's a real hero, was up on the back of his truck. And Jeffrey and I were in this hole, firing away at this ME-1, and was hit in the back with a 20-millimeter cannon shell, which would have killed anybody else. And he only died the other day. Anyway, he survived. And then we eventually got back from Kufra. It was a long drive back across the desert. Got on a steamer at Wadi Halfa and up to wherever the railway started, back to Cairo. End of.
How did you feel about the mission?
Well, I was bitterly disappointed as to what had happened, and I immediately thought back to this open file on the table. But I learned many years later, talking to what is the SOE historian, M.R.D. Foote in the club, told him what I'm telling you, the story. He said, "You're wrong, old boy, it wasn't that. And it wasn't loose gossip, bizarre gossip in Cairo. The Americans were not actually in the desert then, but they had a military mission in Cairo. And they were allowed to have access to our operational orders. They had access to the Benghazi raid, and they sent the operation order in low-grade cipher to Washington. The Germans intercepted the cipher and broke it, and that's why we were expected." And I said, "Is that true?" He said, "I promise you that's absolutely true."
Now, you'd only been attached to them, I believe, well, just for that operation.
That's right. That's right.
What happened next, then?
What happened next? I think my next job, I had this reputation of being able to navigate. Paddy Main, you know, the second in command, the SAS, tremendous chap, DSO and three bars, all that kind of thing, had got lost on a patrol. Vague idea where he might be, and must be out of water and out of ammunition. Could I try and find him? I could. The story goes on. In fact, there's a photograph of the chap who helped me up there, behind. And I got to where this. We were told that the Senussi tribe might be able to help. There was a beer. You know, a beer is a well. It was thought he must have passed that, if you could find it. And a beer is only about as big as that poof. And it was 150 miles away. Find it. And this Senussi chief said, "I'll give you two men. They know the desert." And they were looking very depressed in the morning when I went to collect them. I said, "Why are you looking so depressed? We're not going very far. You know the way. But we've been given to you. We've said goodbye to our wives." I said, "What do you mean you said goodbye to your wives? We'll be back in a day or two." "You mean we're coming back?" I said, "Of course you are. Oh, I thought we'd been given to you." Anyway, to cut a long story short,
anyway, if you could give us the whole story. Actually, before we go on to the story, one thing I'd like to know is, why were you so good at navigating?
As a yachtsman.
What skills did you have that other people didn't have? Do you see what I mean?
Well, yachtsmen navigate. And it's to say, it's the sand sea, it's called, you know what I mean? It's very few features, and you have to. And the use of the sun compass and all that kind of thing.
Could you explain what the sun compass was?
The sun compass is virtually a sundial. If you imagine the sun is constant, isn't it? At midday it's due south. Well, if you have a compass which virtually is a clock, and you set the time on it and set your bearing on it, there's a needle, and the needle falls across there's always sun in the desert. And all you have to do is every 20 minutes you click it on. So you navigate it by daylight with a sun compass because it's deadly accurate. It doesn't have variation or fluctuation. The Bagnell sun compass, it was this famous desert explorer pre-war who invented the Bagnell sun compass.
Were there any other sort of tools or skills you used?
Well, measuring distance, the use of a map, being able to read a map. A lot of the maps were quite useless. I mean, I had one map. All it had was a dotted red line, Rosita Forbes, 1927. And then there was another one, Duke of Westminster's armoured car tracks, 1918. And those are the sort of maps you had. Land here.
Now, what happened then? You went out and you got these assistants from these Senussi.
It's funny,
you were looking for
Paddy
Main. Major?
He was Major Main.
How did they go? What happened?
I was doing my navigation. And every time you come to an obstacle, of course, I deviate, don't I, to go around it and to come back. Every time, these two, I've got a picture upstairs, sitting on the back of my Jeep. Every time I deviated, a hand came down. He wanted to go. I said, "All right, but okay." Soon as I was back on the compass, he didn't understand the compass. Soon as I was back, he agreed. Like that. He knew he was like that. And then when we got, I was working it out on the speedometer. We must be nearly there. And he said, "Stop." He didn't know anything about speedometers or anything. "Stop." He got out, picked up some sand and smelt it. stay here. He ran off like a dog, hunting ground in the desert. I said, come, got it, found it. Then we searched, we found jeep tracks. And I made him say, go there. No, it's going that way, he said. He knew which way the vehicle was going.
So how? How do you know that?
Well, he could see where the tires had gone, you see. They got... That's why this chap had given them to me. Let me, these men, they knew. So then we followed the tracks. Well, Paddy, being Paddy, knew he was leaving tracks. So what does he do? Gets off the bloody sand onto some rocks, doesn't he? To hide himself from being followed. Well, oh, Christ, we've lost him now. I said, oh, no, this chap, like a hound, he kept seeing where a stone had been upset or something, and he followed. We got to a sort of cave place. There was Paddy Mayne sitting.
On his own?
No, he had his driver with him. He was nearly out of water and right out of fuel. It was about time somebody came along, he said. Well, anyway, we've come along. You're all right. That was Paddy Mayne. Great chap.
And so you went back?
Went back to Cabrit then. And then the next raid was the final one, when David Sterling was captured. The Tripoli, west of Tripoli raid, where David decided to try and get through to First Army and was captured, if you remember. And because of this lack of security of the Benghazi raid, we didn't know about this American signal at that time. We thought it was gossip in Cairo. No orders were given in Cairo. We were given troop commands. I was a troop commander. Proceed individually to a map reference, what was it, 150 miles south of Marble Arch, which was that famous place on the road called Marble Arch, the border. Rendezvous. So we proceeded individually to this rendezvous. And David Sterling arrived in a Bombay aircraft. They were those high-wing monoplane aircraft, and landed and briefed us for this. And by now, a whole gang of... I realized that it was getting out of hand, the SAS. There were an awful number of people. Some had never been in the desert before. They were sort of old bayonet pals of David who thought it was a good idea. So,
how many people were there in the force on this mission?
I suppose about 150 people, I think, broken up into patrols.
And what proportion were in use?
Very few, I think, with hindsight. I think it was David Sterling's last fling. He wanted to deploy a lot of people, so he didn't really care them. David wasn't all that good looking after people, you know.
In what way?
Casual. Very brave, but he thought everybody had to be brave. You know what I mean, it didn't matter. And I was a regular officer, but the only regular officer. I'd worked it out. We were briefed. The idea was to go and raid the road, cut telegraph lines, and there was a railway line, and generally bugger about west of Tripoli to irritate the Germans. And I said, I reckon that I got enough fuel to get up there and about 150 miles worth of petrol for buggering about, raiding. How am I supposed to get back? He said, you might well. I asked, he was then General Montgomery, the same question. He said, Colonel by then, Colonel Sterling, when I have captured Tripoli, I shall have no further use for your regiment. So if you get back, boy, it's up to you.
So you had no fuel to get back?
No. Well, we eventually managed to. And that's when I got...
So what do you remember of the mission? Who was with you? Were you in a patrol or...
There was one other officer called Freddy Laugebauer.
Freddy?
Laugebauer. He was a Swede. I don't know how the hell he got there, but he was. I've got the pictures in there of that patrol. I could show it to you. And my orders were more than just doing the road thing. Reconnoiter a route south of Marath, the Marath line. You remember where the Marath line was, which was Rommel's final sort of hold up. Was it possible to get a force south of Marath? And would I reconnoitre it? So I did. And it was horrendously rough country. And in fact, my report was it was not possible to get a regular force that way. But in fact, the New Zealanders did get round, if you recollect, and they did get into Maras. And that was what my task was.
And so you weren't meant to take much part in the raid, or was this on the way before you raided?
Well, this was my primary objective, was to do this reconnaissance. And then if left over, put mines on the road and cut line, telephone lines and things.
Now what was wrong with the route? Why was it such bad?
Rough. Very rough.
In what way?
I mean, rocky. I could show you some photographs there, rock. Very, very, very rough country.
And so you recommended against?
I recommended against eventually when I got back. But anyway, others got round. They got round. They probably found better routes.
And were you involved? So you didn't travel west of Tripoli? You didn't go...
Yes, I was well west of Tripoli. Marath is well west of Tripoli. It was the next... Yeah, next. And David Sterling went on trying to get through to the First Army and got captured. On the way up, when we were still in a herd, you know, all together, out of the darkness, again, I have a photograph, I think I showed you, Wilfred Thesiger appeared out of the darkness. You remember Wilfred Thesiger, the explorer, who was a friend of David, a great Arabist. He was with the LRDG at the time. I said, I heard you fellows were in these parts. I thought I'd pay you a visit. I mean, there we were 100 miles from anywhere, but he'd found us. And he said, what you need to realize from now on in, the natives are not friendly. Up to this point, the Senussi, like that fellow, were very much friendly. He said, from now on, the natives are not friendly. Be careful. And don't think you haven't been seen. You would have always been seen by an Arab. And when we moved on from there, we broke up into our individual patrols then. At last light, we used to light a fire, have our meal, have a drink, and then I used to no lights, drive 5 miles north, 5 miles west, camp, no lights. And this particular night, suddenly about midnight, flash of fireworks and shooting and tracer, where we'd had our meal. About 20 miles further away, similar, that's where David Sterling was, but he hadn't moved. He had ignored Wilfred Thesiger's very sound advice.
So that's why he was captured.
He was captured.
Now, what happened to you? What sort of raiding or action did you take?
What I took was, I'd done my reconnaissance. We got down. It ended virtually disaster down this dip, which I hadn't really appreciated where we got to, and suddenly saw concrete emplacements and wire. I thought, well, God, hell, what is this? We're in the Maras line itself, unmanned, fortunately. So I sort of beat a hasty retreat out of here, drove along. It's a wadi, it's a valley, and a jeep can climb anything, can't it? So straight up, get out of here, because nobody will catch us up there. Nobody will catch a jeep. Got to the top, and what I thought was a bit of scrub on the edge turned out to be a rock. I hit the front of the jeep, somersault. Over, I was driving, fell underneath. I was fortunately saved by the gun mountings, I think, which took the weight of the jeep. My driver was flung out, and it discovered that I'd broken my pelvis. I was completely paralyzed, couldn't move anything.